Tonight's class, we'll be reading from the 10th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. We'll be reading the final verse, text 42, and we will start with invocation. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Shri Shri Radha Gopinath ki. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Okay, some people have some books, okay. Atta vabahu naitena, 42. Atta vabahu naitena, king jatena tavarjuna, king jatena tavarjuna, vishtabhyaham idam krishnam. Vishtabhyaham idam kritsnam. Ekang sena stito jagat. Ekang sena stito jagat. Atava bahu naitena. Kingjatena tavarjuna. Vishtabhyaham idam kritsnam. Ekang shena sito jagat. Please. Atava bahu naitena. Kinjatena tavarjuna. Vishtabhyam idam krishnam. Ekang sena sito jagat. Atava bahu naitena. Kinjatena tavarjuna. Vishtabhyam idam krishnam. Ekang sena sito jagat. Tava bahu naitena. Jatena tavajuna. Vishtabhyaham idam kritsnam. Ekang shena sito jagat. Word for word, please repeat. Atava or bahuna many. Etena by this kind. Kim what? Doesn't fit. Yatena by knowing. Tava, your. Arjuna, O Arjuna. Vishthabhya, pervading. Aham, I. Idam, this. Kritsnam, entire. Eka, by one. Angshena, part. Stitaha, I am situated. Jagat, universe. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada ki. But what need is there, Arjuna, for all this detailed knowledge? With a single fragment of myself, I pervade and support this entire universe. Purport. The Supreme Lord is represented throughout the entire material universes by His entering into all things as the Supersoul. The Lord here tells Arjuna that there is no point in understanding how things exist in their separate opulence and grandeur. He should know that all things are existing due to Krishna's entering them as Supersoul. From Brahma, the most gigantic entity, on down to the smallest ant, all are existing because the Lord has entered each and all and is sustaining them. There is a mission that regularly propounds that worship of any demigod will lead one to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, or the Supreme Goal. But worship of demigods is thoroughly discouraged herein, because even the greatest demigods like Brahma and Shiva represent only part of the opulence of the Supreme Lord. He is the origin of everyone born, and no one is greater than him. He is Asam Mar Dva, which means that no one is superior to him and that no one is equal to him. In the Padma Purana, it is said that one who considers the Supreme Lord Krishna in the same category with demigods, be they even Brahma or Shiva, becomes at once an atheist. If, however, one thoroughly studies the different descriptions of the opulences and expansions of Krishna's energy, then one can understand without any doubt the position of Lord Sri Krishna and can fix his mind in the worship of Krishna without deviation. The Lord is all-pervading by the expansion of his partial representation, the Supersoul, who enters into everything that is. Pure devotees, therefore, concentrate their minds in Krishna consciousness and full devotional service. Therefore, they are always situated in the transcendental position. Devotional service and worship of Krishna are very clearly indicated in this chapter, in verses 8 through 11. That is the way of pure devotional service. How one can attain the highest devotional perfection of association with the Supreme Personality of Godhead has been thoroughly explained in this chapter. Srila Baladeva Vidyabhushana, a great acharya in the disciplic succession from Krishna, concludes his commentary on this chapter by saying, Yachchakti leshat suryadya bhavant yatya ugrateja saha yad angshena Tang Vishvang Sakrishno Dashame Chate. From Lord Krishna's potent energy, even the powerful sun gets its power, and by Krishna's partial expansion, the whole world is maintained. Therefore, Lord Sri Krishna is worshipable. Thus, in the Bhaktivedanta purports to the 10th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavad Gita in the matter of the opulence of the Absolute. I'll read the verse again. But what need is there, Arjuna, for all this detailed knowledge? With a single fragment of myself, I pervade and support this entire universe. So, Krishna is being an expert teacher here. He's given a whole chapter of knowledge about the opulence of the Absolute. And now he's pointing out that although he's elaborated on all these different subjects, there's no point really in getting so caught up with that if you understand that with a single fragment of himself, he supports this entire universe. So he's concluding. So throughout the chapter, he's explaining how he is the most amazing of everything, out of aquatics, I'm the shark, and all these things. He's elaborating his absolute supremacy, and then he is summarizing it here in this verse, quite specifically. So it's not that he is just of aquatics, the shark, one single shark or anything like this. He's not just, you know, he's giving a smaller exaggeration of what he really is, but actually, just by a fragment, he is supporting this whole universe. And not only this universe, but all the universes. We know, according to our philosophy, a quarter of Krishna's energy, if there were such a thing, quarter of infinity, is this material world. And it has innumerable universes within it. And we are in one very small universe. Brahma has only four heads, we think, wow, he's got three more heads than me, but he only has four heads as opposed to many hundreds or millions of heads. There are universes that are much vaster than ours. Of course, if you study cosmology in the Bhagavatam or the Puranas or the Vedas, you find that actually this universe is quite substantially big. And we're here in little Belgium. It's 10 million people, and it's a very small little area of land. I come from Australia. There's only twice the population, but as much land as the whole of Europe. But still, it's just... It's you know, obviously, if you wanted to travel and find every little place in Belgium or a bigger place like Australia or anywhere, you struggle. There's so much there. But there's even more. You go through the whole world, and then there's even more. One time, Tamal Krishnamaraj was getting chastised by Prabhupada, and he was going, you know, out of the vast, vast spiritual sky, which is ever expanding. There is this little cloud in the corner called the Mahatattva. When there's Mahatattva, there's this ocean with unlimited universes. And in this very, very, one of the very small universes, there is a very, very tiny planet called Earth. And in that Earth, there's many countries, and then you have America. In America, you have many states and many cities, and then you have, I think in this incident, it was Los Angeles. And in Los Angeles, there's so many streets, and we're on this one street, and on this one building there, in this one room, there is one manager who thinks he is very big. And he made him feel very, very small. So this is what we're dealing with. This universe is just a tiny spark. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, we have this example of Vasudev Dutt. He was so compassionate. Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati said he was millions more compassionate, I think, than Lord Jesus Christ. Because Jesus Christ, he died for the sins of all his followers. If you surrender to Jesus, you are liberated. But Vasudev Dutt begged Lord Chaitanya to suffer perpetually in a hellish condition so that not a single living entity in the whole universe would ever suffer again. And he was not just sentimental about it, he was willing to suffer that suffering that we could not even perceive. And Lord Chaitanya was explained to be so touched that he liberated every single living entity in the entire universe and refilled it with living entities that were waiting to take birth and have bodies. And when Prabhupada describes this in the purport, he says there are these very big trees with like many, many fruits. And when one fruit falls, you don't really notice because there's so many numerous fruit, you wouldn't even notice. And so this analogy is to point out that there are so many unlimited universes that there is no effort for Krishna just to liberate a whole universe. And then Prabhupada continues, actually, he could liberate everyone in every single universe. This is also not a feat for him. He doesn't do that and then he has to have a break. He has to have a timeout, a pit stop. If he liberates every single universe, Krishna doesn't have to sit down and you know, break a sweat. He can do this. But he explained, the devotee needs to desire this. Vasudev Dutt had such strong desire. Imagine the desire to liberate a whole universe. Innumerable living entities. You go out to a garden and you count how many blades of grass there are, or how many little micro cells there are in every single grass and flying around or whatnot. And if you even try to fathom the number, you'll probably be perplexed. And what to speak of a whole universe or even a country, whatever. So this was the power of Vasudev Dutt's devotion, but this is to show also that Krishna is supremely powerful. It is not difficult for him to maintain this universe. In the Vedanta Sutra, it explains why is this universe here. And the answer is for Leela. This is the purpose, according to the Vedanta Sutra. And Leela means, it explains it's like play, like sports, but there's different examples that the acharyas give of what to explain Leela. Some explain like a king having sports, and Baladeva Vibhushana, he brings the example to a man waking from bed and very spontaneously dancing in joy. In other words, it's not motivated. There's no need. Like, Krishna doesn't need to. He doesn't feel like, oh, I'm lacking in my life, let me create this material world. No, it's simply that he does. It's just like, let's create it. Why not? No problem. I don't have to, but there's no problem to do it. I may as well. There's no obstacle for him to do this. So it's so effortless. It's not like it adds any more difficulties to him. This is how ever expanding he is. And I suppose I've pushed my point enough. It's very, very effortless. Infinitely effortless. So Krishna is this powerful, unlimitedly powerful. And I think I explained in another class, because we're going through very similar subjects, because we've been in the 10th canto, that we are very limited. We are limited according to the Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya's philosophy. We are different in quantity, but practically one in quality with the Lord. I say practically because still there's some differentiation. So we are very limited in one sense. But on top of that, now we are limited by the false ego again on top of that, which limits our perception of it, even our quality as well. So we're already limited in quantity as the small minute jiva, but now we've limited our access to our quality, because the jiva is still Satchit Ananda. It's still full of bliss, full of knowledge, and eternal. But we've even limited that. So with this limitation upon limitations, how can we even fathom the Lord? We can only get a little spark of his splendor. And that's what this chapter is designated for, to just capture that little minute little speck of what Krishna is. And the idea is that you see the tip of the iceberg. As you know, we know the great story of the Titanic. Not even God could sink this ship. And they saw this little, tiny little piece of ice, and they said, no problem. But little did they know that there was icebergs. They're little on the top, but there's so much underneath the surface. The majority is there, and it punctured the ship, and they all sunk, and it was a tragedy. And it was zero for the atheists. I won't say it's one for the theists, because I'm pretty sure that the god worshippers weren't happy that everyone died on that ship either. But yeah, there's so much that was not seen. And similarly, this is like the tip of the iceberg. This is just a single fragment of Krishna's splendor. And as devotees, we get experience of pleasure from chanting or from association with devotees, from hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, from hearing the glories of Krishna and his devotees, stories from the philosophy. All these things give us this little speck of nectar. And the idea is, with the knowledge that comes along with it, we should get the realization that there's more in this storehouse. Krishna gives little samples. And sometimes even immature devotees get premature ecstasy. They get a little charge of the unlimited bliss that's there. And they cry or they have fits or whatever. And Krishna is just giving them a little speck to encourage them. Don't worry, you know, there's more of this to come. You just keep going on this path and you'll find this. And this is ultimately the right direction to go. And it's not that we will then go to the spiritual world and have complete understanding of Krishna. Because even Krishna does not have complete understanding of Krishna. Because his unlimited knowledge of himself is not... Well, he's also expanding, so whenever he discovers something about himself, there is more that is there. And again, we can't understand this because we come from such a limited... starts in passion and creation, and then there's some maintenance, and then it's destroyed, and everything we see is created, maintained, and destroyed. These are the rules of the governing three modes of material nature. Everything here is governed by these modes. There is no mode of passion in the spiritual world, or there is a spiritual realization of where that passion is perverted from. So it's, and there's no ignorance, and there's not even the material goodness. We say shuddha sattva, purified goodness, purified eternity. You know, goodness is maintenance. So we have, this is what we deal with, but we've been given this format, these three modes, and that's it. I guarantee there's nothing in this universe, in the material universe, that's not the three modes. Everything has a creation, everything has some sustenance, and then it has an end. Lord Brahma, he lives God knows how long, but he still dies. And this universe still collapses. Mahavishnu breathes it back in and breathes it back out. Everything is cyclical here. There's no ongoing. People who are recognized as living forever, so to speak, in the material universe, just live for an outrageously long period of time. It's not that they live for eternity. The spiritual world is a place of eternity. And ever increasing and ever variegated. So this can never be fully understood. We can go over it theoretically, and this is a little bit of a repeat of my last class, I think. It's always more, you know. Also in this chapter, Prabhupada is pointing out that demigod worship is condemned here. There are people that think, you know, people say all roads lead to Rome. And sometimes we say, you know, everything is connected to Krishna. Yes, Krishna is the root, and we water the root. Everything is connected to Krishna, but there are still some paths. Well, there's one path, we say. There is one path, and it goes to Krishna, but you can go backwards or sideways or whatever. But there is one path that goes back to Krishna. So some people like to get a little sidetracked, and they worship the demigods. Demigods are in the mode of worship of the demigods is sometimes said to be in the mode of goodness, sometimes said to be in the mode of passion. I've seen both references in the Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita. But worship of the Supreme is the ultimate, because that has the spiritual direction in the end. Because materially speaking, worship of the demigods is favorable, but what comes up must come down nevertheless. Whatever you create with this worship will then be temporary also. Unless you have a spiritual worship, your results will never be permanent. So therefore, unless you take shelter of something spiritual, your value will always be a limited value. Prabhupada uses the example of a spiritual bank account. It's like you put your money in there and you can withdraw your money, but the money remains there. Whereas if you put your money in something else, at death it's gone. You know, whatever money you have, you will part with it at death. So no matter whatever business scheme you have, whatever pyramid scheme you have, whatever great investment, whether you win the lottery, that all goes. But if you invest in a spiritual bank account, however many garlands you make for Radha Gopinath, however many rounds you chant, however much association you have with devotees, however many classes you come to, this will be on your permanent record. It will be chipped in. And whether it's big or whether it's small, it's significant because it remains. It's a complete investment. And so if you leave your body and you haven't achieved Krishna Prem in this lifetime, if you somehow tripped over and you missed the mercy of Lord Chaitanya, which is so causeless and significant and reaches down to the depths, and if it doesn't reach far enough, the Nityananda grabs his arm and reaches a little further. If you didn't somehow capture the full dose of that in this lifetime, then whatever you did will be there, and when your new body is made, that will be already there, and you come with that and you can add straight on top of it. Whereas everything else that you've accumulated, it may be there in your next lifetime for a few more or whatever, but it'll be spent and then it will go away and you have to build it back up. So this is there. What's the point of worshipping these limited beings when we can worship the unlimited? This verse is saying they are simply a small spark of this Krishna. So Why worship the spark when you can worship the flame? This is downstairs when we cook, you have this little spark, and if I try to make breakfast with that, then obviously you think I was retarded. It's not going to heat a pot up. But the flame itself, it generates so much heat. So we don't want to waste our time with these small little things. What else do we have here? Are there any questions and comments at this point? Mark and then Madhu. Or Madhu and then Mark. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, well, like I said, I kind of slipped in because I was saying, you know, spiritual bank account, it builds up and it never goes away. Material bank account, yeah, you can cash in for another few lifetimes, but eventually it can go away. And there's many other stories too like that. It's like they baffle science that these people have this ability from God knows where. There's this boy who he's composed symphonies as good as Mozart, and he's doing it, and he's like he's 12 years old, and he's just, when he was a boy, he was drawing an instrument he'd never seen before that he expertly knew how to play. But this, you can build this up, but yeah, eventually it'll go down. Like I was saying, what is considered eternal in this world, you know, like you hear of Markandeya Rishi, he lives for longer than a day of Brahma. Or some people say a day of Brahma, and some people say two Brahmas or whatever, or Narada Muni or whatever. But these people, Narada is an internal spaceman in a spiritual body, but, you know, these entities that are in this material world as material entities, it eventually goes away. So you could study and pray and worship the demigods, that you become an awesome classical musician or basketball player or, you know, ninja or whatever you want to be. But it's going to run out eventually. And you can keep trying to renew that over and over again, but it's going to require continual endeavor, you know what I mean? Whereas a spiritual bank account, you cash in and you cash out, you know, it's done. You're realigning yourself with your eternal nature, and the closer you get, the closer you stay. And I look at it like a healthy stock, for those who know the stock market. When you have a healthy stock, it always goes up. And of course there's flickering, the market goes, has trends, and there'll be a crash, the market will crash. But if you have a healthy stock, if it's based on a business that actually has some real lucrative business, has some real value, does actually, you know, something that sells, something that's always needed, then it will always go up, and it will drop minute parts. But then, so similarly, you know, like our life, we're still in the material condition, but we're on a spiritual voyage. So sometimes, you know, the devotee drops his beads and doesn't chant, and he gets angry, and sometimes he's chanting 64 rounds a day, but eventually it steadies, like the, you know, the good mode of goodness and steady, and the spiritual is even more so, and then he's gone. Whereas Mozart, you know, he can play for one lifetime, two lifetimes, three lifetimes, but, you know, he's still here and he's getting old. Actually, there is one devotee, he does these past life regressions, and he did one for his daughter, and she managed to sign. This is the story, and she testifies, he has the signature, she signs Mozart. So that's Gurangi, this musician. So actually, Mozart you can research him, and perhaps he did some investment in the material bank account, but looks like he did some investment in the spiritual bank account. Anyway, this is just a story. You don't have to believe it or not, but yeah, just what's your priority? Do you want a foolproof investment, or you want something that's going to crash later? Sorry? He signed his signature. He's got a bigger signature. You know, like Prabhupada's got this huge... So she did a regression with her father. And he said, so what are you doing? And she said, I'm playing the piano. He says, are you good? And she says, yes, I'm very good. I'm the best in the world. What's your name? She said, Mozart. He said, oh, can you sign this paper for me? He went to a museum and he verified it. But anyway, this is, regardless, you know, you can find them and ask them. My story is not to prove that Mozart is reincarnated in Iskon. But it's a nice little story. Yeah, she does, and she's good. I don't know if she's the best pianist in the world. Like I said, maybe he's, you know, he invested one lifetime and now... But, yeah, like, I think what's more important is, you know, Gurangi's got a better position than Mozart because she's writing, even if she's not as good as Mozart, she's writing songs for Krishna. And that will never be forgotten. Mozart, you know, we know him now, but who, I mean, in Vedic time you have so many people, you've seen the Bhagavatam, there's all these kings, and they're just names, and they, you know, ran the universe. So Mozart's so big now because how long ago was Mozart? Yeah, so, I mean, give it 100 years and you might, if you're really lucky and you hang out with really socially intelligent people, you'll get like a Mozart ringtone on your digi God knows what, but, you know, everything fades. C'est la vie. Mark? From Krishna, so many universes. Well, he's blue, you know that. He's not just a normal guy, he's blue. So, yeah, some of the proofs of God's existence or spiritual existence is people, they trace back an origin and they say, you know, there's all these things and something has to create them. We understand that. Brahma, we say, creates this universe. So for all this to go on eternally as it has been going on, of course we may not have so much experience. You know, we only know as far back as Mozart. But some people like Markandeya know long before, but this universe is going on all the time. So there has to be some source. And we say Krishna is the energetic. So just by him, things are created. This is where the achintya beta tattva, this is where the achintya comes in, the inconceivable. Everything in this philosophy can be explained, down to very minute details. But there are still some things that are simply inconceivable because it's totally far out. That he is eternal and that he pervades everything is outrageous, but without that happening, this existence is also outrageous. Like we did the science and religions course, and we got into the Big Bang theory. Finally, you know, one of the most popular theories of the creation of the universe by many erudite scholars and scientists, and you're expecting to see some amazing substance. And one mathematician, very pertinent mathematician, he got into this theory and he analyzed the mathematical possibility of it, and to about the millionth degree, if you rounded this to the closest number, you would reach zero. If you wanted to put this in a substantially understandable percentage of possibility, it is 0% to create a universe that could harbor the chemical consistency to hold life within it, not to create life, to simply hold it, to simply have it available as this concept that could. So, yeah, and great Richard Dawkins, the amazing atheistic scientist, big guy in Oxford, he's saying that actually you mock us because our theory seems so unlikely. But this is the beauty that it's there. And yet you talk of this God fellow who's statistically impossible also. You know, it is statistically impossible to, out of so many men, there is one man who is so mighty. But I think what Richard Dawkins failed to understand is that it's not that God was like these impersonalists said when Prabhupada was around. Jesus meditated, he became God. Buddha meditated, he became God. Krishna meditated, he became God. It's not that some individuals meditated and achieved godly quality and then made universes. It's that God created all these entities in the first place. And you know what I mean? Does this help at all? It's still brought you back to the same point. How? I mean, realistically, he's unlimited, and for him to create something out of unlimitedness is simply just very easy. You know, like, it's if an artist draws a stick figure, it's like kind of like asking us, how could he do something like that? For him, it's so easy to do so much more. But in detail, I don't have his blueprints or things like this. And I can't say, I mean, you can read in the Bhagavatam how it, in what order and things take place and the process. But yeah, it's something quite inconceivable, I would say. Unless Madhu or someone else has something more structured as a. Yeah. It's beyond us. Yeah. It's like the frog in the well. Yeah. 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 To grasp it would be like trying to fill this glass with the ocean. Realistically. Yeah, I said like in the previous class in Prabhupada says, this is the story of the frog in the well. We're in such a limited circumstance. We're like a frog in the well. And if someone was to tell us about a great mass of water like the ocean, it would be impossible for us to conceive. But realistically, on a philosophical level, we can look around us and, you know, you can see that every day there are trees growing from seeds. There are other entities growing from little tiny cells, little babies of all sorts of creatures. And this is going on, and this world is just, it's full of life, you know, so. We have to use this philosophical understanding. One of my friends, he's Hari Bhakti. He's a very good classical music, Indian musician, and he moved to Australia, into our community, and these tourists came to visit our temple, and they had some question like this, you know, like, what about, you know, but God, you know. And he said, you know, in India, I mean, he wasn't speaking for anyone in India, but he's just using that mystique. He said, in India, the idea of God is not such a big deal for us. It's like when you go to the shopping mall and the door opens for you automatically, do you just think, well, this door came? No, you you use your intelligence and you realize there is some mechanism and that someone has created this mechanism. So similarly, there is a God and he's created this mechanism of this universe, because otherwise how is it working so well? Even the atheistic scientists, they say that this earth is so well placed, it's virtually impossible. Like I said, it's like mathematically impossible for their whole creation to go about, but however it came about, it works. And it's working like outstandingly. Like there is some great intelligent being designing it. So there is enough to show us that there is quite a large possibility that there is amazingly unlimited person. How he does things is inconceivable, but things are getting done, you know. So if you know nothing about construction, how they construct a castle like this, or, you know, so many people are wondering how they made the pyramids in Egypt. No one knows, but they made them. So I don't know if I can answer your question, but... No, it's... How is yeah, it is like a virtually unanswerable question. It's just there, you know. It's like how it came from Krishna's energy. Well, you know, scientists say it just came from a big bang. All of a sudden, time and space were created. Where that came from, if you ask that question, that's a religious question. So it's like, yeah, there's something great and we're so limited and we can't fathom it. So, but it's a worthy question to keep in your mind, because it's a good place to search, you know. It is. Yeah. It is a very natural and it's a good question. And sometimes people use it to antagonize you or to create doubts themselves, you know, like, how can it be so? But it's a question you can be comfortable with. If someone asks you, say, well, how does anything work? How does DNA work? The scientists can tell you all about it, but they don't know how it works. They can tell you some functions. You know, we can tell you some of the effects of gravity, but why and how exactly it works, this is beyond us. Newton made some theories, and even in his time they were controversial. And now we use them like God's eulogy, but it's like, it's very uncertain how things really work or why they really work. But, they are working. So, anyway, it's one thing you could ask Krishna one day. I don't know, I'm sorry, I'm not qualified to answer it. I wish I was. No, it's a very good question. I like the questions when you get to the point where there's no answer, you know, there's no easy answer, because that means you're testing the limits of knowledge. You're not just asking silly questions. That's good. Okay, anything else before the Kirtaniers take their constitutional position? Grantra Chirana Bhagavad Gita Ki.